Hello, and welcome back to an exciting new season of the Edible Oceans podcast. This is season two. So thank you all very much for being with us. My name is Edith Wilson-Sousa, and I am Professor Tony's audio and production assistant. And I'm the one that edited this audio. So for our very first episode, we have Sofika Kosniuk, who is the managing director of the Aquatic Life Institute. And that is a nonprofit organization that seeks to improve the welfare of aquatic animals in the fishing and aquaculture industries. You can find out more about their work at www.ali.fish. But otherwise, I'm going to let Sofika and Tony talk about all of the amazing things that they've accomplished, and I'm just going to get out of their way. So take it away. I forgot one tiny little thing. So the interviews for Edible Oceans podcast are conducted live in the field, not in a studio. So please forgive any little audio artifacts that I have not been able to edit out. Back to the interview.
Yes. Hi, Tony. So I'm Sofika Kosniuk, and I'm the managing director at Aquatic Life Institute. We're a 501c3 nonprofit charity in the U.S.
Oh, well, it's great to have you on the Edible Oceans podcast, Sofika. And we're looking forward to a discussion around issues around animal welfare in the marine environments, which is something we haven't touched on before. So, yeah, I'm wondering if you could give us a little bit of an idea of what some of the main issues are as you see them and as your organization sees it in the seafood sector.
So aquatic animal welfare is a relatively new conversation, very new actually, in the wild capture seafood sector, and somewhat new in the farmed fish or aquaculture sector, although fish farmers need to keep the animals alive and grow them out to market size to sell them. So whether they call it welfare or not, they have to take care of the basic needs of the animals. So it's more relatable to the farmers than to the wild capture sector at present. This issue, however, is also very new to the animal welfare ecosystem overall, because arguably cattle and pigs and sheep and chickens have had many of these considerations in place for several decades already, and there are many models that we've adapted for aquatic animals. But even in that terrestrial animal space, relating to aquatic animals has been very challenging for a lot of players because aquatic animals don't vocalize in ways that we can relate to. We don't see them a lot of the time because they're under the water. So they've sort of been the ones that have always been left behind and forgotten, but there are, in very conservative numbers, 2 to 3 trillion individual animals every single year that are caught or farmed and killed for human consumption, for things like fertilizers, for nutraceuticals, so your omega-3 vitamins, and so on. And we just have been thinking about them as inanimate objects as opposed to sentient individuals who lead complex lives and ones that have incredible abilities, just ones that humans haven't wrapped their minds around yet.
Yeah, I think recently it comes to mind is this incredible documentary, the My Octopus Teacher, you know, which has really affected a lot of people, having, you know, before had no idea of, that humans could have a relationship with an animal, a marine animal like that. Well, could you perhaps lay out a little bit some of the issues that you see affecting both the sort of the aquaculture, the marine farming on the one hand, and on the other hand, the wild-caught sector?
Yeah, absolutely. So they are quite different in terms of the interventions that we're seeking. And again, it's because of the different nature of the relationship that humans have and the interactions that we have with the animals, whether they're living in a confined farmed environment or wild, and then we simply catch them and kill them. What we seek to do is just lower the suffering or the discomfort and stress of the animals that are in the system. So for the aquaculture space, there are five key welfare pillars that we consider, and we want farmers to begin incorporating into their practices. So water quality, the water quality needs to be at an appropriate level to have enough dissolved oxygen so the animals can thrive in the environment. We need the feed to be appropriately administered, not overused. If it's a carnivorous fish like your salmon and your trout and your shrimp, they're actually being fed a lot of the time other smaller fish in something called fish meal fish oil. So there's all these hidden costs and hidden loss in biodiversity. We want to move the industry away from using fish meal fish oil to sustainable forms of feed that are plant-based. Algae is showing a lot of promise there. Stocking density, so how tightly do we cram these animals in together? And we know certainly from land-based animal farming, the more stressed the living condition of an animal, the more susceptible it becomes to disease, to aggression, to other problems. So we need to have appropriate stocking densities and then stunning prior to slaughter. Now, this is something that is used almost not at all in the aquaculture space, and certainly almost not at all in the wild capture space. But if we kind of think about killing a pig and not slaughtering it appropriately, not giving it some kind of comfort prior to killing it, that would be sort of unimaginable, likely illegal in the majority of jurisdictions, but for aquatic animals, we just haven't been putting in place these considerations. That's what we're advocating for. In the wild capture fisheries space, the suffering is of a far smaller duration, a far shorter duration, but the intensity is astronomical. So we're catching fish in these enormous nets, often from very great depths, and putting them through barometric trauma as they come up to the surface, which is a lot of the time the cause of their death. We're crushing them in these nets, we're bottom trawling and having all these bycatch issues, we're catching rays and sharks and birds and turtles on these long lines. So there's so many better ways that we can adapt our gear to ensure that it is appropriate, selective, and doesn't cause all this collateral damage. And then, of course, when the animals are brought on board the vessels, we need to stun them immediately and to be fully unconscious before killing them.
Yeah, it seems like some of the, the goals that you're seeking would be very useful in other ways in terms of, you know, the impact of trawl nets, for instance, on ocean ecology on the bottom of the ocean is... they've been very damaging, proven to be very damaging. So if we were to have more humane practices in the fishery, not only would it have animal welfare implications, but presumably it would have some very positive implications for the wider ocean ecology, don't you think?
Yes, I couldn't agree more. There's actually very, very strong correlation between higher welfare practices in aquaculture and fisheries and links to climate change. So not bottom trawling and releasing all that sequestered carbon back into the atmosphere. We're preserving biodiversity. We're not damaging habitats, as you mentioned. We could... foreseeably, actually, if we use far less of that fish meal fish oil that's often coming from the global south in the form of anchovies, herring, sardines to feed other fish, that could actually be going to feed hungry populations around the world. So there are many, many additional benefits and correlations between animal welfare and truly a more sustainable way of living.
Yes, I mean, that's one thing that people that maybe you know, eat their salmon don't think about too much is that that salmon has been eating fish that could have been caught maybe by relatively very, very poor fishermen in the global south, but those fish are no longer available to them because they've been already caught to feed salmon and to provide stock for the salmon food industry. I'm wondering if you could now just give us an idea of how your organization hopes to, you know, implement or achieve the goals. What mechanisms do you hope to use to make them come about?
Yeah, so a lot of people outside of the movement and the food industry haven't heard of Aquatic Life Institute, our organization, but that totally makes sense. It's pretty much by design. We work with key stakeholders, policymakers, so governments, both global and country level governments. We work with seafood certifiers, and we work with large scale seafood buyers, like your grocery stores or large hotel chains. To create the change that we want to see happen. Consumers are always an important part of the equation, but we just don't have that amount of time and resources to invest in consumer education and bringing the population on board. They will choose a higher welfare product when it becomes available through their grocery store, through their restaurants, or when it's legislated in their countries, and then it's just a standard offering. So we were kind of behind the public face of the work, and we need to create change at scale. We just don't have a lot of time. Like most governments and like most corporations, our line in the sand is that 2030 deadline by which all of our practices collectively need to significantly change and improve if we want to stand a hope of living, you know, a reasonably enjoyable life, that we can have the resources that we need to move forward.
Do you ever foresee something like a humane harvest label or something possibly coming forward to, you know, that consumers would see on a seafood product in the future?
Yeah, I think that's something that's very exciting, and probably we'll start seeing that on store shelves in the next few years. And the reason that I believe this is going to be the case is that we're already seeing policy shifting. We've had the UK government back in 2022 introduce the Animal Welfare Act for decapods and crustaceans, so lobsters, shrimps, crabs, octopus if they're selling them, that they are sentient animals and deserve basic rights. As a result of that, this kind of domino effect, we're now seeing leading retailers in the UK introduce new policies on procurement, their buying policies. So just last summer, we were working with both Marks and Spencer's and Waitrose, two really large retailers in the UK, and they rolled out public policies that anyone can read through on not only higher welfare practices for shrimp, but also humane stunning prior to killing these animals. So we're seeing that play out. We know that the food space is incredibly competitive, and leading retailers, leading restaurants, leading hotel chains really take a lot of pride in being first or in that first batch of corporations that are moving on a new issue. So I think they're going to come out and celebrate it widely, and then the industry will respond with a certification, because then it'll be something that consumers recognize and people are willing to pay. If it is a higher quality product, then they'll be able to identify it, and the increase in price will be justified. So I think that will be coming in the next few years.
Well, that's very interesting and very, very good to hear what you're doing. It sort of brings to mind the work of Aldo Leopold, and perhaps it's time that we extended the ethical ethos that we have for terrestrial animals that we take for food to marine animals that we take for food. So thank you very much. Really appreciate your time with us on Edible Oceans.
Thank you so much, Tony. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and hopefully some of your listeners will also learn something and change their practices as well.
Thank you so much to Sofika Kosniuk for coming on the show. You can learn more about the Aquatic Life Institute at ali.fish. I'm Edith Wilson-Sousa, the audio and production assistant for the show. I also manage our Instagram, which you can follow us on at @edibleocean_podcast. Professor Tony Winson did the recruiting and the hosting for the interviews. If you'd like to contact him, you can reach him through his website at theindustrialdiet.com. Please remember to rate and review the show on whatever platform you use to listen. It really helps other people find us. And finally, this podcast was made with assistance from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada.